Well, let's see. That music, that was really amazing. I'm kind of blown away by it. Thank you very much. So, I had the privilege of speaking at Anne Bancroft's ordination. In fact, I had the further privilege of being the one to charge her, the charge to the minister. And as far as I can tell, she's doing exactly what I told her to do. How lucky for you all. How lucky. You know, I haven't seen her since that day, and as I was preparing to come down here, I happened upon the folder of my sermon that day. So I brought it down, I looked at it last night over dinner, and I said, boy, this is long. And, you know, Anne's so discreet, right? She, oh, I don't. I can't take credit for telling her to be arrested, but I certainly should have told her that. I'm very, very proud of that. I also want to reference Anne's sermon of last week, which I asked her to send me, and which I loved. I hope you all were here. Don't miss one of Anne's sermons. She's one of the best in our movement. But she talked about the, you were all there here? Yes, good, okay. The code of the very familiar, and the wonderful, just in case there's some visitors today, the wonderful story of the fish saying to another fish, how's the water? And the other fish says, what's water? And then she beautifully wove that into the fact that we live in a society, in a culture that is a white supremacist culture, and that white supremacy is what we swim in, and it's sometimes hard to see it. So I'm here to talk about the other element that we're swimming in as well. It's deeply connected, but namely the earth. So we are swimming, we are living on the earth, but it's very difficult to see it sometimes. Even in Vermont, I have to say. We swim, Anne said, that this culture we're swimming in is about money. She said, we need to learn to see the water in all its nuanced and seemingly invisible forms. Once you start noticing, you realize it's everywhere, and it dictates so much of our common lives in ways that we simply weren't awake to before. How beautiful is that? She was talking about white supremacy. I'll be talking about the earth today. They are one and the same. The desecration of the earth is one and the same, and the desecration of minorities. I had the privilege recently of hearing Cornel West speak up at Dartmouth. I teach at Dartmouth on the side. Pays the bills. And I get to meet amazing people like Cornel West and Winona LaDuke. Do you all know who she is? Fabulous woman, wonderful talk. But Cornel West gave this wonderful, really, it's a sermon. It wasn't an academic lecture. It was an hour sermon. It was fabulous. But I raised the question at the end, could you say a little bit more about the earth? He mentioned climate change, but that's it. We all need to keep weaving these things together. Winona LaDuke, of course, talked a lot about the earth and the oppression of indigenous people. It was really amazing. That's my preface. I think I've said what I wanted to say in preface. Oh, no, I do one more thing. Something I said at the ordination of Anne Bancroft. William Blake has taught us imagination precedes reason. Of the imagination, Wallace Stevens writes, quote, I am the necessary angel of earth, since in my sight you see the earth again. We must never forget this. We must remember to meet out in the country where there is no shame, where things melt into spirit and heaven, where things melt into spirit and heaven is found in this branch, in this morning's sunrise, found in what Donald Hall calls the luminous particular. Now, the concentration of the wild. I took a walk last week up the dirt road near my house. It's the same walk I have been taking for 40 years. First with one dog, then with two dogs, then two dogs with one child, then two dogs and two children, then two children and one dog. And yesterday it was just me and a very old dog. Not a 40-year-old dog. Several generations later, but she is, dear one, old. Just me and the old dog and my dying into spring heart. The sun and the grass peeking through, leaving the pale green of early spring everywhere on the pasture. The road is a perfect rolling dirt road through pasture and hay fields, ending at the farm, the owners of which still miraculously own and keep. I am so grateful to these people. Poor and isolated, they could become millionaires overnight with the selling of their acreage. They could move to a posh townhouse and dine out every evening, attend opera in New York, travel around the world. And yet they stay poor, holding on to what they love. I'm grateful to them, not only for the road I walk with such reverence and in such rich solitude, but because of what they teach me by example. They hold their cup empty for a greater truth. Because the pasture has not yet come in, we're about 2 weeks behind you down here, I walk across it up to the bluff just beyond the trees, just before the trees. There at the edge of the field, I sit where I have sat 100 times, where I sit in the sun of early spring, surrounded by dead grass which surrounds and protects the new shoots. Have these new blades of grass been here since the fall, or have they burst forth so much already without my having noticed them? Millions of new sprouts interspersed with the dead. For as far as my eye could see, the dead and the living all mixed together in a green and brown collage of New England's cruelest month. But this moment I have just described is unique and rare. Mostly, I am an all too typical human, distracted from distraction by distraction. T.S. Eliot. I wasn't going to give it away, but the human species is the distracted species. The last few years I've been teaching animal studies, fascinating, all the new research. I just can't say enough about studying animals, because then we look at ourselves, we are called animals. I mean, we are animals, and then actually the technical term is non-human animals, so that we make sure we remember that we're animals. We are the distracted species. We are the animal who talks too much. And worries always about the wrong things. You know that, don't you? You know that if you're worrying, it's always about the wrong thing. Okay. We are stuck too often in the terrible either or of reasonable men. Let's hear it. I've preached in Tulsa. They yell amen and hey sister and speak it out. Yeah. It's on YouTube, by the way. My son just said, why haven't you told people about this? We are stuck too often in the terrible either-or of reasonable men, as opposed to the both and of the poet. Another way of talking about our species' particularity, in contrast to all the other mammals we are just beginning to understand, is that we humans are the thoughtless species. We are the thoughtless species, or more generously, we are the species capable of thoughtlessness. You didn't tell, you told me they were kind of, this is great. She's done a good job working you up. We are the species capable of thoughtlessness. Of course, I can say that because, as we so often pridefully say of ourselves, we are the animals who think. Which is true, though we are not the only animals that think. Turns out they all do. Who knew? We all knew. It's just the scientists that didn't know. That's really a serious comment, actually. Read Jane Goodall on that issue. She suffered terribly because it, you know, wasn't provable. But they're getting there. They're doing great stuff now. So our human language is symbolic. We live in symbolic cultures, so there is no fixed system of signals. As, for instance, in mice or muskrats. You know, muskrat wakes up, knows what he's going to do today. We wake up and we go, our DNA doesn't tell us. Their communication, though, as far as we know, has none of the nuance or ambiguity or complexity that we seem to have. We humans live in memory and a certain fluidity of language that is startlingly complex, miraculously beautiful, at least to us. Where have you been all my life? Nevertheless, our thoughtlessness, like our population, abounds. Made most famous, perhaps, by the philosopher Hannah Arendt's famous book, Eichmann in Jerusalem. Hear, hear, yes, her New Yorker reporting on Eichmann's trial, which some of you remember watching on television. It's one of my first television experiences. While everyone was calling Nazis monsters, so evil as to be from another planet, Arendt dared to say that the more serious problem and the more accurate description was that Eichmann was not extraordinary. Evil, yes, but not because he was some monster from another planet, but quite the opposite, because he was so ordinary. Because, like most of us, he was thoughtless. The full title of her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, The Banality of Evil. Other animals do not have this problem. They are not evil in this way. In fact, I doubt anyone would say any animal on this earth is evil or thoughtless. Rather, we understand that they are playing their part in an intricate and delicate web ecosystem within this miraculous living organism called Earth. But somehow we humans do have this problem. We go off script. We ad lib. We Twitter. Our non-prescriptive DNA doesn't govern us. Some philosophers call this free will. Some say our brains are too big. However you describe it, it allows us to think and it allows us to not think. It allows us to be kind and it allows us to be greedy. It allows us to speak symbolically, to think abstractly, and to disassociate from thoughts that make us uncomfortable. When I think I'm wearing shoes made by child laborers in Bangladesh, for instance, I become very uneasy, cognitive dissonance. As when I walked out of the documentary Food Inc., I hope you've all seen that. Years ago I saw it, swearing I would never eat chicken again. Or when I watched Cowspiracy, another must documentary, and declared that I would become vegan, and then I didn't. I'm working on it, but I'm not there yet. It is easier to stop remembering. It's easier to dissociate, to bracket it out. Easier to forget that we forget what we know. Even it's easier to forget that we do know something. Thoughtlessness indeed is in some cases not only a defense or an easy way out, but sometimes the only thing we can think to do in the moment. Of course, we can't think of all suffering of all animals, including humans, all the time, can we? So here we have it. We choose our focus, our cause. We do what we can. But what if only in a moment, what if only in a moment, we could be fully thoughtful, fully present? Settle into that animal part of us that is in full attention. What if for a moment we could come into Yarak? Full readiness, awake in mind, body, and spirit, and walk into the light as if our life depended on it. To truly do this would be to turn our world upside down. In the words of the great poet Jane Hirschfield, in her preface to 10 Windows, she writes, "The ears and eyes must learn to abandon the habits of useful serving and take up instead a participatory delight in their own ends." I'm going to read it again. The eyes and ears must learn to abandon the habits of useful serving and take up instead a participatory delight in their own ends. The not-so-hidden agenda here is that we step out of our Genesis-generated anthropomorphic skin into a worldview that has us as part of this organism called Earth. Not hovering above it like the anthropocentric God of the good book. And he saw that it was good. Really? Wishful thinking? Not all good. Bare November days and short. Tumid apathy with no concentration, Eliot writes. Tumid apathy with no concentration, men and bits of paper whirled by the cold wind that blows before and after time. And while we're on Genesis, I remind you, we are the species who ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The serpent was way too smart to eat of this tree. We ate it. And so we judge because we think we know what is good and bad. And of course, sometimes we do, but most of the times we don't. The Taoist story, I'm sure you've heard a million times, I won't repeat it, because you have this big, huge clock on the back of the wall for people like me. I have never seen a bigger clock. I preach regularly in Chester, Vermont. It's a beautiful little church. If you ever come north, please come visit us. And one day in the pulpit just appears, there's no clock in the back, appears a little ticking clock. Like it, right? And I'm like, okay, what's this? A little hint? I took it out of the room. I couldn't stand the ticking. Where was I? The story I'm not going to tell, yeah. So sometimes we know what's good and bad, but most of the times we don't. And on the thoughtless mode, sometimes we fail to make a judgment and perpetuate an evil system. I won't think about what I'm doing. I'll just go to work. I have to go to work. Running the trains was a job. I can't think about climate change. I'm hopeless. I'm helpless. What can I do? I want to speak this morning about this great fact that we are animals, that within and without us is a wildness, just as for other animals. A wildness which does not mean being out of control, but rather means a concentration. I thought Amanda had given my entire sermon and I was about to leave, but then I remembered I wanted to make this point. The wildness is not being out of control, it is concentration, it's being in Yarak. This is what we can learn from our cousins. A fierce life force of attention and intention, which if we can learn to tap into it, will not only save us as individuals, but will save the species and will ultimately save this earth. So I have a long quote from Thoreau's Walking, which I'm going to send to Anne, and she's going to email it to all of you. And in fact, you should read the entire essay, but I'm going to move on to my own words here. In the context of today, we have an alternative to distraction. We have an alternative to thoughtlessness. This is nothing new. Religions, on their better days, preach this same message over and over and over again. The alternative to thoughtlessness, the banality of evil, is concentration. The concentration of other animals practice all the time and can teach us. The concentration of being on this planet as part of this intricate web of unspeakable beauty. The concentration of being present, being awake. Spring begs us to practice this attention. From Thoreau's Journals, another book you should have at your bedside, as Rachel Carson had at her bedside. This is 1855. I find it good to be out this still, dark, mizzling afternoon. My walk or voyage is more suggestive and profitable than in bright weather. The view is contracted by the misty rain, the water is perfectly smooth, and the stillness is favorable to reflection. I am more open to impressions, more sensitive, as if in a chamber still. My thoughts are concentrated. You believe I found this passage? My thoughts are concentrated. I am all compact. The solitude is real, too, for the weather keeps other men at home. The mist is like a roof and walls over and around, and I walk with a domestic feeling. The sound of a wagon coming over an unseen bridge is louder than ever, and so of other sounds. I am compelled to look at near objects. All things have a soothing effect. The very clouds and mists brood over me. My power of observation and contemplation is much increased. My attention does not wander. The world and my life are simplified. My message to you this morning, to us this morning, I always preach what I need to hear. Walk, walk into this May morning. Walk into solitude, into such sorrows as we each carry. Walk into them. Welcome them. Walk with such joys as we each hold. Walk into the mizzling afternoon. Walk with all five senses into thanksgiving. Let the clouds brood over you. Let the fog of early morning increase your concentration. Bring you into full readiness, into Yarak. fully awake to play your part in this particular unfolding spring of our dear planet, our dear planet's mystical and miraculous ever-changing abundance. Fly, dear ones, like the hawk. Run like the catamount. Walk gently like the bear. And don't forget to sing. Amen.